Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we're going to share with you some of the excitement that we experienced at this year's James Beard Foundation Awards,
which were last Monday evening at Lincoln Center, if you're totally out of touch with what's going on.
Well,
and, in the restaurant and food world, and didn't know that. That's where it happened.
It was very busy. We had the Fashion Institute Gala as well, and the Lincoln Center. There were a lot of glitz, plus the red carpet for the Beard Awards.
You wouldn't have noticed there were a lot of people at the Metropolitan Museum of Art for the ceremony you just mentioned, because it certainly was a packed house at the Beard Awards, and we were a part of it, and part of the reason why we didn't get to talk to everybody we wanted to was because everything was so packed. But we got a wonderful sampling and people with different views about what it means to them to actually receive an award. A couple of people were semi-hysterical, a couple of people were so calm, it was almost...
It was a busy, busy night.
But it was a busy, busy night, and you'll catch some of that background information on background noise, unfortunately, on the interviews themselves, but
the press room was a zoo, more so than
still,
usual.
But it's still possible to find. Anyway, let's just dive into the awards themselves. One of the most prestigious awards of all is Best Restaurant across the United States. And our old friend and good buddy Daniel Ballou from Restaurant Daniel in New York City won for that, and he was just beside himself. He was so excited. Now, you want an opposite point of view, David Kinch, chef at a wonderful restaurant called Manresa in Los Gatos, California. He was so laid back, it was really hard to believe he was alive. You almost wanted to take a pulse to make sure that his heart was still beating. Then back to excitement again, Sean Brock was so humble. He said he really didn't deserve the win, but he thought it was absolutely wonderful.
That's wrong, because he did deserve the win.
And he told us how he cried his eyes out in the men's room. Right after he got the award.
Well, don't give away our interviews.
Okay,
Why don't we just let them speak for themselves?
And then the last one is a couple of gentlemen who moved from all the way from California to Maine. They have several restaurants. The main one is Arrows, and Arrows won a James Beard Award at the seventh time of asking.
Okay.
So that's our first lineup. We're going to put all those interviews together. I'm sure you'll find them most interesting.
It's no secret that we love Daniel Ballou and his restaurants. And I'm so thrilled, Daniel, that you won Best Restaurant in the United States. This is a major award. How do you feel?
No, this is certainly maybe the biggest award I've ever won. I think I have had recognition for my talent as a chef. I had recognition for our wine service. We had recognition for certainly our pastry and everything, but this one is for everyone who worked for me, and it's for what Daniel represents. And so I'm very proud. I hope and I feel and, to all the staff and all the effort they do, it's a wonderful gift.
You amaze me, even though I've known you all these years and your restaurants have always been so spectacular. You always have another project, and it's always even better than I ever would expect. Run through your restaurants right now. I mean, let me mention the one I'm looking forward to. Everybody in London is like, hey.
That's the latest one. And, I think for me, the excitement, not only of cooking, but of our business, it's what drive me every day. And the wonderful people who work for me. And lately, yes, we have a new project in London, a Barbouille. And I'm very excited about it. I think it's going to be a little touch of New York there. It's very important for me. And at the same time, what matters all the time for me is Danielle. Also, it's my home base. And it's my home and my home base. And it's where I also spend most of my time in the kitchen. And so today to have Danielle have the recognition of Best Restaurant in America, I am very proud of that.
I can tell you that every time we're in New York, we go to one at least of your restaurants, and you always show up. You are an extraordinary restaurateur. Now you're going to do London. That's going to be a little tougher.
Yes, of course, but I hope that they'll be kinder to me. I hope to be a kind addition to them, but also then they'll be kinder to me. But at the same time, I think, you know, it's very exciting for America today to see it, and we are reaching out of the country and showing our pride also in cooking, and I think it's wonderful too.
Now I want to just say before I turn the microphone over to Peter that all of my colleagues in London are so excited they could barely stand it, and you're going to be side by side with Esther Blumenthal.
Absolutely, at the Mandarin Hotel in London. I am opening first, Barbulu, in late May, and in about 2 weeks. And then after Esther Blumenthal, at the end of the year, we'll be opening also a restaurant. We don't know the name yet, but we'll be the two of us together there on Knightsbridge.
I know exactly where that hotel is for reasons that I won't reveal on the air. What I wanted to ask is, when are you going to open a Michelin three-star restaurant in Paris?
That I don't think it happened. Maybe I'll open a little bistro so I can entertain all my good friends when they go to Paris. But, and maybe in Lyon, why not? But otherwise, no, I don't think I will open a three-star Michelin any other places than Daniel in New York. And I'm very happy with that.
Now, listeners around the world, of course, and all you listeners in England, Barbulu itself is not Daniel. Give a 30-second Barbulu for all the listeners in London who are going to be able to go there.
I think for anyone around the world, if they want to experience Daniel, they have to come to New York, period. Now, if they want to experience Daniel Boulou, they can go to London and have Barbulu. Barbulu is very much where I'm come from. I'm from Lyon, and Barbulu is this sort of Lyonnaise bistro with a very large program on charcuterie, the tradition of charcuterie. And also the wine, Burgundy and Rhone, are encasing this program of charcuterie. So it's a wine bar bistro with an emphasis on Lyon, my hometown roots.
Well, okay. Love you. Love Danielle. And thanks so much for talking to us.
It's so wonderful for On the Menu Radio to meet someone who's a well-deserved winner. David Kinch from Manresa Restaurant in Los Gatos, California. What does it feel like?
It feels great. Thank you for the very kind words. That's very, yeah, it feels great. I mean, I certainly can't complain right now.
Mike Latta from Figgins in Charleston, South Carolina. He could barely contain himself. Now you're, Mike Latta, you know Mike, I'm sure. He could barely contain himself. Now you're really very calm.
Well, I'm trying to remain calm. I think I'm kind of raging inside right now, but maybe on the surface I'm a little bit calm. I'm very, very excited. I'm very happy for our team at the restaurant because this is a great vindication for all our hard work over the years.
And you're going to share it undoubtedly with your friend from the farm, too.
Absolutely. Of course. Of course.
Will you do anything different as a result of this?
No. I don't want to change. I want to stay on the same path that we're doing. Every day is a great opportunity to try to make ourselves a little bit better and take care of the customers, and that's what we're going to continue to do.
And farm to table is, which is a sort of a theme of this evening, I think. That's you and...
Well, it's, I mean, you know, it might be a theme, but it's how we work. It's how we've operated for the past 15 years, and we're going to continue to do so. It's always the quest for the best ingredients possible.
The theme this year, actually, is the legacy lives on. And... who was your mentor, and who are you mentoring?
Well, mentors, I have several. I have several mentors. I have several people who have influenced me in various aspects of my career. And the thing that gives me the greatest satisfaction now as a chef is actually seeing young cooks who work for me, who move on and do their own thing, achieve success in their own way, and carry on the legacy that we started at Manresa. That is certainly the most fulfilling aspect of my career so far.
Again, many congratulations. I'm sure you can hardly wait to get back and enjoy it with your team. Where will you celebrate tonight?
We're going to be all over, I assume. I don't know where we're going to start, but it's going to be a good evening tonight.
It's going to be a long night, David. Thank you so much for talking to us. And once again, our heartiest congratulations.
My pleasure. Have a great evening tonight.
Tell me that again, Sean Brock from Charleston Restaurant McGrady's.
You know, I'm sitting here with this award around my neck, and it's so surreal that I'm not even sure that it's real. I don't think this is real. I just can't believe it. I don't deserve it. The other nominees are way better chefs than I am. You know what? Today, I made my mother proud.
I bet you did. Now, you said it more succinctly a moment ago. You said, I can't believe
can't believe I won a James Beard Award. Are you kidding me?
I already had an intro, and you stole the mic. My intro is, Sean Brock sits here and he says, I can't believe I won the James Beard Award. And I say, I can't believe it took so long. How long was it, Sean, when we first encountered you and McCrady's? I mean, it was like years ago.
Well, for 2 years, I was nominated as a Rising Star Chef, which is a national award. This is my first year as a regional Best Chef nomination. So
that means you got older.
That's why I can't believe. Yeah, I'm too old. I can't believe it. I'll tell you what. I spent 10 minutes in the bathroom crying my eyes out.
Oh, I can't believe that. I thought you would have cried your eyes out last year when you didn't win.
No, like, you know, you just can't. You really can't translate the emotion. You know, I called my mother, and, you know, for the last 2 years, I had to call my mother and say I lost. And this year, when I called my mother, she was crying her eyes out. And so I did as well. I had to hide in a stall in the bathroom, and I cried my eyes out like a little baby.
Now, a lot of your background, we've interviewed you before, so people can go on our website, onthemenuradio.com, or the audio archives, and listen to your stories about how you were working your restaurant, raising your pigs, doing all that stuff. But I can't believe, with all the success you've had, you didn't understand how good you were, and I thought it was a disgrace that you never won before.
I grew up in the rural South, and this is pretty amazing. I don't expect these things in life. I've never expected them, and I'm sitting here experiencing it, and I still don't think it's real. I'm honest.
It's real, and you were real good.
Interestingly, everybody has been sort of noticing. So somebody wrote you up recently as one of the most influential chefs in America. Do you remember who that was?
Oh, man. That pressure is, when you read those things, you know, those things are, they make you feel good for a second, but then there's always someone else who has something bad to say. So it's just a matter of living life and knowing what you're doing is the right thing, and knowing that feeling is the right thing, and that's all that's all we can do. That's all we can do. It doesn't matter what people say, whether you're good or bad. Those things don't matter. What matters is when you put your head on your pillow at the end of the night, you can smile and say, I'm doing the right thing.
Now, there might be a little party in Charleston when you get back, do you think?
Oh, my God. We are going to party so much. We are going to have so much fun. I'm already having so much fun. I just, this is surreal. This is surreal. I don't deserve this, but I will take it.
Well, we'll.
You deserve it.
Well, we'll next time when Charleston, we'll be sure to catch up with you. We'll find out if it went to your head, but I bet it probably didn't.
It will never go to my head, and I can't wait to see you guys in Charleston again. I can't wait.
I just want to tell you, I love you, Sean Brock. I've loved you from the minute I ever met you, and I just think you're fabulous.
On the Menu has met several 5-time runners-up, 7-time runners-up. Tonight, we have a 7-time nominated winner. Mark, introduce yourself and your restaurant.
I'm Mark Geyer from Arrow's Restaurant in Ogunquit, Maine. And yes, 7-time nomination, finally winning.
And you said your heart was pounding just a little bit again tonight because you thought you might finish up with another one in our last column.
I actually had a feeling that perhaps we were going to win tonight, but my heart was pounding out my chest because I was afraid the last moment that we wouldn't, but we did.
Now, you were up against some pretty stiff competition too, right?
Yeah, a lot of very good chefs, and it's a real honor to be in that whole group of chefs. And to win, it was a wonderful thing. They all do deserve to win, but somebody has to lose, and we did for 6 years. So it's nice to win, finally.
Well, I think that's wonderful. Now, tell our listeners a little bit about your restaurant.
We have three restaurants, but our flagship restaurant, Arrow's, is in Ogunquit, Maine. It's on 5 acres of land. And we were doing farm to table before it was trendy. We started growing our own in 1990, and it's evolved into it's a seasonal restaurant. We're open 9 months of the year. We grow all of our own produce during the growing season in Maine. And also in the non-growing season, we use a greenhouse and covered rows. It's a beautiful, beautiful piece of property with, like I said, 5 acres with flower gardens, vegetable gardens, an orchard. It's absolutely fantastic.
Now, you must know Melissa Kelly from Maine also, and she's very big on the same thing, right?
She and Price are good friends of ours. We see each other not nearly as often as we'd like to. We do events together occasionally, and we always enjoy being with one another and have a tremendous amount of respect for both of them and what they're doing.
Do you know David Kinch from Manresa? We just talked to him a moment ago, and he has a farm in California where he grows things 12 months out of the year. Aren't you jealous of that?
I am a little jealous. He has a real edge on us because he has a year-round growing season, and we have about 6 months, if we're lucky.
Now, introduce your partner because he's busy talking to somebody else, but we were going to talk to Clark and Mark. Sounds like a wonderful combination, so let's just get his name into the recording too because...
His name is Clark Frazier, and we started cooking together in California in 1985, working for Jeremiah Tower and Mark Franz at Stars. And we moved to Maine in 1988 and bought Arrows, and we've been working there for 22 years.
Well, it's wonderful. I share your excitement. Tell us again what it feels like. You can say yowie if you'd like.
It feels awesome. It really does. I don't want to swear, so it feels absolutely, absolutely wonderful. Very, very happy feeling.
Well, the FCC doesn't govern us, so you could if you wanted to, but thank you for your discretion anyway. And we're threatening to come to Maine for the first time very soon, so maybe we'll stop by and see you.
Please do. Please make good on that threat.
Thank you so much, and once again, congratulations.
Pleasure. Thank you, sir.
And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And Ann and Peter Haig had a great time in the press room. We had fabulous cheeses. We also had champagne.
And some wonderful British gin called Plymouth. But that's a story for another day.
And caviar. Farmed caviar.
Yeah. But let's get back to the business of this next upcoming segment In addition to going to the James Beard Awards, we dined at several excellent Manhattan restaurants. One we've been looking forward to is a restaurant called Aldea. I think I'm pronouncing it correctly. The chef is of Portuguese heritage, although he was born in the United States. His name is Jorge Mendes. And George sure was a busy guy because flying around because he wasn't in the restaurant when we got there to start our dinner at 6:30. We finally caught up with him about 9:30 after we completed dinner. And sadly, you'll find that there's quite a lot of background noise because there was a crowd there having a really good time. and, of course, we were recapping the wonderful time that we had with George and talking about Portuguese cuisine.
And it was nice to meet him because he really is a nice guy.
Yeah, and it's of great interest to us because on the menu he's got an upcoming visit to Portugal, and we're going to test out some of the things that he told us about. But in the meantime, here's George talking about his restaurant, Aldea.
Okay, listeners, this is the third take because we're interviewing after dinner rather than before dinner as expected at a wonderful restaurant called Aldea in southern Manhattan. We're going to talk in a moment to the chef owner of that restaurant, but I wanted to preface this whole interview by letting you know that for those of you who don't know, Portugal is the oldest ally of my native land, England. George didn't understand or remember why. I don't either, but we're very glad we're here. Even more surprisingly, I have a master's degree in geography from the University of Cambridge, and a number of my colleagues there knew the dictator of Portugal, Salazar, who before that was the professor of geography. Now, what do you have to say about that, George?
I have no comment. I mean, I think people definitely have that from previous careers. I mean, you got to edit some. Sorry, that was a, now I missed it. Salazar was a former professor of.
He was a professor of geography at the University of Lisbon.
Yeah, and then he became the leader.
Then he became the leader of the country.
Right.
You know, I have to.
Come on.
I've been here.
You have to jump.
I mean, it's
the things that make you scratch your head, I think.
What I like is the food of Portugal. And we have this very good friend, Tony Pies, who's Portuguese, who cooks at Bismarck. And he's always encouraged us to go. And we are going to Portugal.
We are.
We're going to Lisbon, at least. Just, I mean, I don't know.
You're
going to
have a fantastic time. The city's very rich with both classical restaurants and modern restaurants right now.
We got really excited because we're coming to Manhattan, and we knew you were Portuguese, and your restaurant was Aldeia, and it was Portuguese.
Yep.
And so we came here, and it has been like a real trip. I mean, it's like wonderful.
Thank you.
Explain to us how much Portuguese you do here at your restaurant.
I mean, it's a basis, it's a reference point for all of my dishes. I mean, I think the menu, it's very strongly influenced by the seasons right now being spring and where we base our tasting menu on. But, you know, my flavors are global. I mean, I use a lot of influence from Japanese culture, from Southeast Asia, from the whole entire globe. But my reference point is definitely Portugal, and a lot of the dishes are Portuguese and Spanish as well.
But Portugal was a great trading nation anyway.
That's right.
So I guess there was...
We're the gateways to the Mediterranean.
There were always ingredients from around the world
part
of your cuisine.
That's right. You know, Vasco da Gama, a very famous seafarer, explorer, he discovered the first sea route to India and came back with a lot of spices.
Tell us a little bit about your signature dishes, because I'm going to move on from there, because this is like a really fun spot. Tell us your standard Portuguese dishes that everybody loves.
The shrimp alinho would have to be the first one out of our appetizer section. I mean, it's a very, very simple shrimp preparation, alinho meaning garlicky in Portuguese, and it was something that was made for me as a kid by my mom and dad. And when I became a chef professionally and through my training, a lot of my mentors always taught me to always try to amplify the given ingredient's flavor, never mask it. And when I put the shrimp alinho onto the menu, I took the standard classical recipe, but then gave it a little bit of a boost by making a really intense sauce from the heads of the shrimp, because we get the shrimp whole with the heads on, and we roast them, and you know, we add the mirepoix and vegetables and brandy.
Alan Richmond liked that one a lot.
Yeah, Alan Richmond, he was great. Yes, I think he ate like three or four dishes of it. And I mean, that's basically where it was. It was a dish that I ate as a kid. The holidays were revolved around lavish banquets, and you know, my mom and aunts would slave over the stoves for 2 days previous to that, and the shrimp dish was always one of them that was on the table. It's known to be something that you eat when you're gathering. It's kind of like a canapé or an hors d'oeuvre or something that you arrive at someone's home, or you arrive at a restaurant, and that's usually the first thing you get while you sip a cocktail or you have a glass of wine. So that's the starting point for the shrimp alinho.
Now, where do you get this wonderful shrimp from? Because we had some really top quality similar shrimp just the other day.
Yeah.
They're not damp. They're not soggy.
When in season, I do get them from Florida. Florida's sweet shrimp. They're fantastic. But right now, we are getting head-on shrimp from Ecuador, actually. And they're just an amazing flavor. The flavor's in the head.
Okay. Could you give us a couple of other rundown on your wonderful signature dishes?
Another rundown?
People love to know.
Yes.
They love to hear about the
shrimp alinho. And then in the other part of the menu is the petisco section, which are like small bites, small plates, if you will, small plates. And we have the Knollcrest Farm Egg, which is a farm in Pennsylvania that comes to the Unscrew Green Market. And we take a classical Portuguese approach to it. It's bacalhau à Brás, which is basically cod, salt cod that's cooked or mixed in with scrambled eggs, crispy shoestring potatoes, black olives, and parsley. And then we make that preparation, and we pipe it back into the egg itself. It's a little snack, and we serve it with a wooden spoon. So it's like a 2-3-bite thing. People really enjoy that. It's something that people sit down at the table, and they get to eat that first before their main appetizer comes. So that works out really well for us. on the sea urchin toast. That's my Japanese influence. I love sea urchin, and it has a lot of Asian flavors going on there.
Am I wrong? You lived in Japan?
I did not live in Japan.
I have been mixed up then with somebody else. I thought somebody else lived in Japan.
Yeah.
But you are enamored with Japan.
I am enamored by Japan. It's some of my favorite cuisine. The passion, the craftsmanship that goes in, and the simplicity and the purity of the cuisine it inspires me tremendously.
Now, seafood is a big thing in Portugal because...
Yes, it is.
Because of the coast.
Because, yes, right.
But you have this wonderful fish called monkfish.
Yes.
But you do something a little bit different with monkfish.
It's the approach to the monkfish dish, and we're using the cheeks. It's put together with a stew of razor clams, potato, fennel, and saffron. And the reference point for that dish was a Portuguese dish called a caldeirada, which is a cousin to a bouillabaisse. So I've taken all of those flavors and kind of refined it and zoomed on, you know, the monkfish cheeks and the razor clams being the shellfish in that dish. Traditionally, caldeirada is something that would be put together based on the day's catch or what was fresh in the market. So it would almost always include monkfish, and then there would be mussels and shrimp, and then of course potatoes and a lot of tomato, a lot of paprika goes into flavoring that, and of course white wine. So that's basically the dish. That's what it is.
Now monkfish in Portuguese is
tamboril.
Tamboril. Now in Spanish it's rape, right?
Rape, yeah.
It's a different, so it's a totally different name. So even though these two countries share a border all the way along,
yes,
the languages are quite a lot different.
Yes, we can understand each other for the most part because both languages are Latin-based. So we're very close friends, we should say.
Now you have another dish, which you would probably say from Portugal, it crossed the border into Spain, and the Spaniards would say it crossed the border into Portugal. It's a version of paella.
Yes, it has been labeled a paella, although that was definitely not my intention. I mean, it is a Portuguese dish at heart. It's the arroz do pato, which translates to duck rice. And again, it's me taking a very rustic, simple grandmother's cuisine. It's just rice and duck flavored with chorizo and olives, but I've taken a French approach to it where I made the duck confit out of the legs and made a really intense duck stock to cook the rice with, and there's a sofrito base for the rice first with the tomatoes, onions, garlic, saffron, and tomato. That gives the rice a lot of backbone. And then we crisp up the skin separately. So you got duck cracklings on there. And then we have the duck breast itself that's cooked sous vide. So you have a lot of textures going on in that dish. It's very flavorful. Whereas in Portugal, their classical recipes were a little bit more simple. But when you eat the dish, it's still duck and rice.
How did you learn to cook?
I learned to cook from, well... My mom and dad definitely was the starting point. And then I went to the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park, and then I traveled extensively.
You graduated.
Yeah, I'm a CIA grad. Yeah. And
you're using technical terms.
Yes.
So I'm assuming you understand that side of the business.
Yes. Yes, I have. But it's I'm still learning, I feel. I definitely feel like I'm still learning. And opening up Aldeia has been a heck of a roller coaster ride for me. And I still, you know, discover new ingredients, new cooking approaches, new flavor combinations. And I like to travel a lot. I like to visit friends at their restaurants and get inspired by them. But cooking is an ongoing thing. It's you're constantly evolving, finding new roads. And that's what makes it really exciting.
Well, we had a fabulous dinner.
Thank you.
And I am so excited to meet you, and I'm going to follow you because you're going to do great things.
I really appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Well, we're pretty sure you are anyway.
And
I said we're pretty sure you are, and I'm pretty sure you think you're going to be that too.
I just got to keep working pretty damn hard. That's what it takes. It's the work ethic that my mom and dad instilled in me.
Is there someone else who inspires you? I mean, you've met all these wonderful people. You starred with people that on the menu knows, including their wonderful Martin Berasategui.
Yeah, Martin Berasategui and Lazarte.
Isn't he fun?
Yeah. What's that?
No, actually, he's not fun. He's really brilliant.
Martin is a brilliant man. He's a big inspiration to me. I spent some time with him in his kitchen.
I'm not sure he's
technician.
So much fun.
Yeah, fantastic technician, very creative.
We called him the king of flavors.
The king of flavors,
the
good
king
one.
Of flavors. Because of all the chefs we ate in that region, we ate several in this wonderful region with top chefs, but he was the taste man. He was the flavor man.
Yes.
And we took a picture of him underneath his painting, but he really wanted us to go into the kitchen.
I have a picture of that one too.
And we took a picture of him with his entire crew in the kitchen.
That is fantastic.
He's next to one. Maybe he were even there.
What year?
It was 2 years ago.
No, it was not.
You were gone.
It was our, I was embarking on building this place.
But you understand this team thing.
Yes. It's important. It's an equipo, as the name in Spanish. A team is what makes the restaurant run, both front of the house and back of the house. And if you don't have a good strong team to back yourself up, I mean, it's not a one man show here. It's not a one man show anywhere. And I think that every restaurateur or every chef will agree to that.
Well, I'm sure that's true because Chef marched in 10 minutes before we did this interview. The kitchen turned out a wonderful dinner for us.
Yeah.
This is Aldea Restaurant. Give us the website.
AldeaRestaurant.com.
You should come here. I don't know what neighborhood's in, but...
We are in Flatiron District of Manhattan, right on the brink of Union Square as well.
You catch a cab, you're right down Fifth Avenue, you're here in a moment.
That's
and
right.
And you'll have a wonderful time. And you can tell that because the background noise is... Well, listen, we just hope you're going to be able to hear this wonderful interview because it's been so much fun recording it. George, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
And we'll pause now for a short commercial.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, continuing to find people in the crowds that we could get some really interesting reactions from. A very important award is every year the Rising Star Chef, which is a prediction of greatness and success in the culinary field. And, Thomas Keller we'll hear from later on, but he's had a lot of luck with producing Rising Star Chefs, and this year was no exception. So we're going to be talking to Tim Hollingsworth from the French Laundry, followed by Mark Forgione, who, now this is something we haven't even mentioned yet about the event, is the grand reception, all the food stations. It was a legend in the field. A legendary chef gets to invite someone they've mentored that they're very proud of. And it was amazing that there were father and son duos that came up, including Jean-Georges Van Gerik and his son were on one stall. And here's another one. It's Mark Forgione, Larry Forgione's son. And then our final award winner is also, it's very important, this is Humanitarian of the Year Award.
And it's a fascinating story related to the NFL from a restaurant owner in Minneapolis who had a brilliant idea in 1992 and he's been running it ever since. I think you'll be fascinated by it, and those of you from Pittsburgh will be particularly proud of the Pittsburgh connection to this event, so be sure to listen for that.
Hello, Timothy Hollingsworth, Rising Star Chef. How does it feel?
It's an honor. It's pretty amazing.
You have to give us a little more than that. You have a minute and 30 seconds left.
It feels great. You know, it feels amazing just to be considered amongst all these guys and my colleagues and the support that they've given me and the friends that I've made through the different accolades. I'm very proud and humbled to take this award.
Now, you think it helps that you've been at the French Laundry and a few other... So the stars have been through there?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Thomas Keller is a big name in the industry, but not for no reason. You know, he's a very talented chef, and he's an extreme mentor to me, and he's extremely supportive and an amazing person.
Now, if you could name one thing you've done at the French Laundry that sort of made it more like your restaurant, what would that be?
You know, I think that everybody does that. All of our employees on a daily basis, we all come to work and we really try hard and work for ourselves and for the guests. And together with that teamwork, that's what makes the restaurant what it is today.
And what's your top dish on the whole menu? All the time it's on there. What's the thing you like to cook the best?
Well, it's hard because we change the menu every day, but the oysters and pearls is one of Thomas Keller's signature dish, and he's very, it's an amazing dish. It's a celebration course. It's, you know, champagne, caviar, oysters, savory sabayon.
Hello, we know Thomas fairly well. Are you as much a really strict perfectionist?
Yes, he is. He's,
Now, are you?
Am I? I try to strive for that on a daily basis, and I think it's something that you can never really reach or you can never obtain. But you really want to push yourself and push the others around you, and they'll push you in return. And hopefully you'll get better, and you'll better yourself, and the food will be better, and the guests will be happier, and you'll create memories.
And your favorite thing to cook?
I love roasting chicken and simple food, cooking pizza, stuff like that.
When you call your mother, what will you tell her?
I'll tell her I love her and that I miss her, and I wish she could have been here.
And will she believe you won?
Yes. She already told me she knew I was going to win. She's very proud of me, and she's loving and supportive and really an amazing person.
I can't wait to get to know you better and know your work more. Mark Forgione, you have a fairly heavy name.
Yes. I don't hear that enough.
Did you ever have any choice of career?
Believe it or not, he actually told me not to do it. He recommended that I live a, I don't know how you say, an easier life.
Now, this is your father we're talking about.
Yes, yes. And
whose restaurant?
Yes, well, I kind of left a little early to try and figure out if there was something else for me to do, but I found myself cooking for fun. I'm very blessed that I have fun at what I do. Not everybody gets to do that when they go to work every day.
Okay, now, bring us up to date on exactly where you are, what restaurants, who's doing what.
I am at my own restaurant. It's called Mark Forgione. It's down in Tribeca on Reed Street. My brother, Brian, I'm the oldest. My brother, Brian, is the second youngest. He is the sous chef at a restaurant in Las Vegas called Cafe Society. And believe it or not, my youngest brother, Sean, just started cooking at a little, like, barbecue place or a little grill-type place on Long Island in Floral Park.
I didn't know that. And your father?
My father, he's right now consulting for PJ Clark's and, looking for the next thing. I guess we'll see what's out there. And he still has an American place, of course, in St. Louis.
Now, your mother, I don't know very much about your mother.
Believe it or not, my parents met at culinary school. So she can hold her own with all of us in the kitchen. Believe it or not. She makes the best meatball in the family.
Yeah. I guess Italian mothers make good meatballs, except for me. I never made a good meatball. But anyhow, what are you thinking about this beard event?
I think it's really cool. I mean, I remember being a young kid coming to the beard, the ones in Rockefeller Center and coming to the awards and, you know, kind of following the old man around, and now to actually be cooking at them, and it's a feeling of accomplishment. You know what I mean? It's nice.
Now, do you have your own style cooking?
Yeah, I think I took what my father started as far as American cuisine and local, and now people are kind of pushing the envelope with different microgreens and different herbs, and but it kind of goes back to my father being one of the first chefs to say, hey, can you go get me some morels? Now I kind of go to these people and say, hey, why don't you try and find me something new and interesting that I can use at my restaurant?
When I think of your father, I think of how far ahead of his times he was.
Yeah, it was Whole Foods before Whole Foods was here.
But you've caught up and even gone more so.
You have to keep pushing and pushing and pushing. My father and a bunch of other chefs, obviously a lot of them were up on that stage, set it up for us, and we have to continue, not to take it from the James Beard, but, to continue the legacy,
What would you really wish for the next thing to happen to change the current culinary scene?
Without causing too much of a ruckus, I would like for chefs or young cooks that are coming out of school to be more concentrated on being a chef than a TV star.
Amen. Thank you so much. I've loved meeting you.
You're welcome. Anytime.
Gets to be a real zoo at the James Beard Awards later in the evening, but one of the most important awards that happens is a humanitarian award, and I caught up with Wayne. I don't even have a note of Wayne's last name, but I thought we have never interviewed anybody in this category before. It would be fun to recognize everyone who's contributed in this way, and Wayne, introduce yourself and tell us your story.
Well, I'm Wayne Kostrowski, and I have a day job. I'm a restaurateur and a baker up in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And in 1992, the Super Bowl came to that city and the state of Minnesota, and I'd been involved with hunger relief for a long time. And I thought it'd be a good idea to try to maybe begin a legacy at Super Bowl that would raise awareness and dollars for hunger. And it was called Taste of the NFL. Simple idea. Bring in a chef that represents each city where there's a team, pair him with a player from that team, throw a party, and give all the money away to hunger. And now we're going into our 20th anniversary year, and we've given away over $10 million to food banks across the country, and we're looking forward to our 20th anniversary in North Texas this year. And this humanitarian award is probably the most humbling thing I've ever received in my life, and it's pretty exciting, but it's kind of make sure that I've got to work a little harder from here on out.
Now, the funniest thing is I was in Minneapolis 2 days before that Super Bowl, staying in the same hotel with the Washington Redskins.
The winners. They ended up winning that game. I hope you had a scarf and mittens and hats and all that stuff. And it was a great Super Bowl. But, you know, in a northern city like that, we had to be more creative. And I thought it was a great year to start Taste the NFL. And, you know, many of the chefs have been with us all these years. We've got, you know, Bobby Flay is on our board. Tom Colicchio helps out. Rick Bayless and... It's a great thing, and the nice part is that everybody donates. Food, players, chefs, and we try to give away as much as we can each year and distribute it to all the food banks in each of the 32 cities. So it's not just Super Bowl City. It really hits families across the country.
We're from Pittsburgh, and we like our football team there. Who do you deal with in Pittsburgh with the Steelers?
Andy Russell, of course. He is the legendary. And a great story. I'm glad you mentioned Andy, because every year at the Taste the NFL, we have the players. We throw down a challenge. You know, they're kind of competitive guys. And we say, look, we got a helmet at each of your stations, and you know, we want you to bid it up as much money as you can to auction off that helmet at your station. And they normally get like, you know, $1,000, $2,000, $3,000, $4,000. It's about the highest we had up until this last year. But Andy said, I'm going to set the mark on this thing because I'm from Pittsburgh and we do things a little bit differently. His helmet and package, he put in other tickets to games and things like that. Andy raised $10,000 just at his food station, and that means that the food bank of the greater Pittsburgh is going to receive a check for $10,000 from Taste the NFL because of Andy's work.
Well, it sounds like a wonderful idea. Wayne, thank you so much for joining us. And we have a special connection. Do you want to mention it on the air?
I love our connection, Peter. As soon as we met, got your name. My son, my only son, is named Peter as well, and I knew that we were going to be okay here, and we're going to connect, and we're going to see each other down the trail here a lot, I think.
Well, keep up the great work, and thank you so much for joining us on the menu.
Thanks. Enjoy the rest of the chaos here. This is fun.
And now a commercial break one more time.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and next up, Thomas Keller.
Yeah, what a way to finish out a program.
Yes, and it's always interesting talking to him, inspirational talking to him. He's just such a great interview and great person to talk to. Thomas Keller won the Best Book Award from the James Beard Foundation for Ad Hoc at Home, which is probably to date one of his most popular books because it does translate to the home cook.
Thomas Keller is, of course, a world-renowned chef and very much esteemed. And you have 9 restaurants and a brand new book. Is this your fourth?
This is our fourth book, yeah. Very happy, very very proud of it.
And, well, you should. It's called Ad Hoc at Home and subtitled Family Style Recipes. And it won for the best chef restaurant category, best cookbook at the International Association of Culinary Professionals, and just now took best cookbook at the James Beard Awards. I mean, your other cookbooks were beautiful, truly, but everyone is raving about this one. Is it because you think that it's accessible?
Well, you know, accessible is a term to be defined. I think, you know, I believe all the books are accessible, but I think the difference with this one is it's recognizable. Uh-huh. I think when you have things like, you know, fried chicken, you have meatballs in there, you have the soups that we have included, as well as things like lemon bars, I think those are really recognizable, and people feel like they can do them. So I think there's a lot more confidence from the consumer going into this book with confidence about being able to do some of these dishes.
Well, I have two questions. One, I wanted to comment on that. I think that there's a certain whimsy and like pictures of you smiling, which are not typical, and you as the Cape Crusader, which I'm not sure how I respond to that.
That was fun.
Yeah, so so you were having fun with it.
We had a lot of fun with this, yeah.
Yeah, and the other thing about it, I think, is that it seems more personalized. You begin with the story of cooking the last meal for your father before he died.
Yes.
So it's sentimental in a way that I guess a lot of people would think Chef Thomas Keller's not the most sentimental person on the planet, but it turns out you really are, after all.
Well, you know, there's a lot of emotion in this book based around the food that we did, food that we do at Ad Hoc, that family style. Mm-hmm. And certainly around my father's passing. So I think that this book really resonates on a lot of different levels than something like the French Fondue or Under Pressure or Bouchon.
Right. Now, the other thing that I think I can't remember when the first time I interviewed you at the French Laundry in Yountville, it must have been 20 years ago. How long ago was that? It was very
Probably about 15, I should think.
15 years ago. It was an altogether different scene at the time. But I was impressed, even then, that you are a born teacher.
Well,
and
this book
proves it. And you have even a photograph yourself with an apple in front of a chalkboard, which is very clearly a teacher situation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you have these step-by-step photos, how to truss a chicken and whatnot. And then you also have what I just adore are your light bulb moments, mm-hmm, tips and mm-hmm. techniques, which, I mean, I've cooked for years, and I find them absolutely illuminating, no pun intended on the light bulb.
Are there a couple of examples you can think of, Tom, that in that light bulb category?
I think there's a lot of great information, I believe, in this book. I was a writer, so I'm a little bit cheated. But I think at the beginning, where we talk about becoming a better cook,
I love that.
Yeah, I thought that was really nice.
We talk about using salt, I think, which is critical, because so most people were confused with seasoning, and we always think that seasoning is salt and pepper, when it's actually not. I mean, the seasoning element we're looking for is salt. You know, it enhances flavor, where pepper changes flavor. I think that's a critical thing. I think big pot blanching is a great technique that can be used so many different ways and so many different times of the year. I think that's just one of those basic techniques that everybody should understand. How to saute, braise, pan roast. Oh, those are very, very interesting bits of information there. We talk about tools and equipment and the impact that that has on your ability to execute well. You know, we can't go into a kitchen and expect to really produce, you know, a fine meal. And when I talk about a fine meal, I'm not talking about a fine dining meal. I'm just talking about a fine meal, basic, simple meal, without having the right tools and equipment. And then talking about mise en place or being prepared, you know, step by step. And I think there's a beautiful picture in there about the soups, the one soup that we do. And it's all the different garnishes, all the different items that you need to make that soup. Think about that when you're preparing to cook something, is what are the different steps that I have to go to? What are the ingredients I have to have on hand? And having all that ready to go before you actually start the process. And cooking is a process. We have to appreciate that. However simple or complicated cooking is, the recipe is, it's about a process, and we have to respect the process and go through the process and enjoy the process.
Now, I remember you inspecting your chef's mise en place, plural, and at the restaurant at French Laundry in the kitchen. You are meticulous with that.
It is the foundation for success. Mm-hmm. I mean, with mise en place, you're just there's no way to be successful. I don't really consider a really good cook. If I'm not prepared, I'm not going to be successful.
I wanted to ask you a slightly different question, Thomas, because I think, no, I don't cook from cookbooks a lot.
Mm-hmm.
When I do, I'm looking for the exact measurements to go into something, and I make something. But if it fails, I may not try to make it again. Now, that's probably wrong. My guess is you would advise that if you want to cook something successfully out of Ad Hoc at Home, you might expect to try to do it two or three times before you get it just right.
You bring up a good point. We talk about repetition as being the key to success. The more you do something, the better you become at it. And it's very true. I really encourage people to continue to cook the same things over and over again. They really get good at it. It becomes fun. It becomes second nature. And you get that sense of confidence that you need in a kitchen. If you're trying something new all the time, you're always on thin ice.
I like that. It's sort of like when Thomas Keller lost his shoes.
Yeah. Thanks for reminding me.
You remember we talked about that last time we talked to you when you were in Pittsburgh.
Thomas, I find it amusing that the cover, I mean, I love the cover of this book. And once I saw it, I could never forget the book. I mean, it's just a pig with a butcher's diagram of cuts. But that is the front cover of your book. And yet almost all conversations talk about your recipes for roast chicken.
Well, roast chicken, I think, is one of those
I mean, you have pork recipes, but the thing that seemed to strike everybody in the right chord was your chicken, your poultry section, especially the roast chicken.
Here in Ad Hoc, I think roast chicken is one of those basic, as it is in a lot of cookbooks. I think to be able to make a really good roast chicken is one of those basic techniques that you want to be able to accomplish. And there are two things for me in roasting a chicken. Three things if you want to include brining, but brining is not necessary, of course. Brining really adds another level of flavor because the seasoning gets to penetrate deep into the meat. But brining is not necessary to do a really good roast chicken. What's really good, really necessary doing a good roast chicken is being able to dry out that skin and temper that poultry. And drying out the skin may mean leaving it in the refrigerator uncovered for a day or a day and a half so that the skin has a chance, the moisture that's in the skin has a chance to evaporate. And when it evaporates, it's going to shrink, so it starts to tighten up around the breast.
Yeah, I thought that was a good point.
Oh, right. And then tempering. Tempering is critical and something that we don't really embrace in our country. Letting the food sit out at room temperature until it comes to room temperature where it actually can cook evenly.
Well, it used to be that my generation did that, but currently, I guess I don't do. But resting is Peter's strength.
Well, it's only because I learned that. Mm-hmm. I heard enough chefs talk about it to where I realized that it's something that I ought to try, and then I found out that indeed that was absolutely the thing to do. But mm-hmm. it seems like it was a chef's secret. Now, when I grew up, my mother was an awful cook, and so you could tell the meat was already going to be dead, so there was no real sense in resting. Because there was no juice left to move around.
Right. Sorry about that.
But when we had Michael Simon on the air talking about roast turkey at Thanksgiving, he said the most important piece of advice is to cook it to, I think it was like 1/6 short of the degree of doneness, and then let it rest for 45 minutes.
Exactly.
And he's absolutely right. And it's one of the things that chefs know that I think home cooks don't. So it's very smart of you to emphasize that.
Now, this book actually gives a lot of information like that. When Thomas said it was felt good information, it was not just being flippy. I love the section on how much oil to use with your sauteing.
No, it's important, to remember that. When you're sauteing something, there's no point in putting too little oil in the pan.
Right. That's what I think. Now, Anne can't fry.
I cannot fry.
She can't fry because...
But I don't like fried foods.
Because she's frightened of oil.
Well, it's true. I mean, it's a dangerous element. I mean, you have to be careful with it. You have to have the right size pot.
I hate greasy food. I mean, I can't stand it. It's just
remember, we don't use grease in cooking. We use oils. In fact, we use grease when we're in the auto mechanics.
But you know what I mean. It turns
I know
my
what
stomach.
You mean.
I mean, it's like, what's that... Oh, Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Yeah, but it's poorly fried. If you have that feeling, then it hasn't been fried correctly.
A really good fried
piece of chicken shouldn't be oily at all.
Yeah, well, my friend who's the great fryer told me I never let the oil get hot enough. And you addressed that issue about how you lower the temperature putting the food in and so forth, which some people don't even think about. But I thought that was a great section.
Well, good.
Yeah, and I also liked your section on lifesavers. Tell us about that.
Well, lifesaver, it gives you some components, some preparations, some basic things, marmalades, chutneys, different types of mustards that can be used in a savory way as basis for sauces, basis for vinaigrette. You can add them to mashed potatoes, if you will. You can make, you can do all kinds of things. You can use it as a condiment, if you will, having a piece of grilled chicken and the artichoke mustard, for example. I mean, there's just so many different ways to use this lifesaver section. And they're also fun to make. You can put them up. It's that old style of canning, of jarring things. It's just such a wonderful way of preserving some fruits and vegetables from different times of the year.
You gave a lot of space to salads, which are beautiful, by the way.
Thank you.
And, of course, you mentioned soups. You love soup.
My father loved soups. It was, in the beginning, every meal began with a soup.
That's old-fashioned, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's
a very English thing to do. Usually it's something like Brown Windsor.
Brown Windsor sounds awful.
Which I'm sure is made with washing up water, which is exactly what it looks like. Now, I meant to interject something, Thomas, when we were talking when you were talking about fried chicken, because we asked Teston Blumenthal, who was an early guest, on the menu, we said, "What do you cook at home?" And he said, "Roast chicken," right away. He said, "That's what the family likes, and that's what I fix when I'm at home." Now, what about you? What do you fix when you're at home?
Exactly the same thing. It's such a satisfying thing. You know, a beautiful roasted chicken. I love to roast it on vegetables that I'm going to enjoy with the chicken. You know, it's like a one-pot meal. It's easy. It's convenient. It's a wonderful thing. It's satisfying. It's gratifying. It's recognizable. It has all those flavor profiles that you like, whether it's white meat, dark meat, skin, the wing. You know, it's just extraordinary.
I love it, too, but mine doesn't turn out like yours.
It can.
Oh, I'm going to follow it, really.
Yeah, dry the skin and temper the bird.
I'm going to do this, Thomas, really.
Okay. All right.
And I wanted to mention, you find trends, sort of, in chefs' cookbooks.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them just I find so curious. We've interviewed about several chefs very recently, who were very anti-tong. What is that, something that's just popped up? Or
I don't know. We've never used tongs in our kitchen. They tend to damage the food.
Well,
either by squeezing it together or crushing it different ways. So tongs are a way to keep a person away from food. I want people to have contact with food.
Well, that's what
Barbara Lynch said, no tongs in my kitchen.
Right. No tongs.
And then the other thing is, chefs seem to be passionate about eggs. I mean, there's that whole book of chefs on eggs.
Well, eggs are the perfect food, really. I mean, it's the only food that straddles savory and sweet. It's the only food that you can have for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I mean, think about it.
Uh-huh.
You know, eggs are just it's a complete food. I love eggs.
Well, they're
not to mention the shape of them. The shape of them is so elegant.
Oh, yeah. And then the other thing I was going to point out is you come right out and say, because every time we interview somebody, it's sustainable, locavore, stocked. You are for sustainable, and you are for local, but you don't mind getting the best ingredient if you have to send for it, right?
Well, I think local is defined differently. Certainly local is relates to geographic is very relevant within a certain amount of distance from wherever you live. You know, that certainly is the old definition of local and still pertains, is very important. But there's also local as it relates to product and support. You know, somebody like Keith Martin, who you know very well.
He's local for me.
Right. But he's also local for me. But it's also very important for me to support him, because if I don't support him, or chefs like me don't support him, what's going to happen to somebody like that? He's not going to be able to stay in business, and we'll be in danger of losing his voice. And his voice is so important in our industry.
Well, I mean, we've certainly come full circle around to when my great uncle had a farm, I must say, and all the neighbors shared their product. Well, I think that this book is important for people, not only because it's doable, usable, designed for home cooks, but also I think that your love of cooking, an emotional attachment to what you're doing, comes through as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I was wondering, how much cooking do you do now?
As much as I can,
uh-huh.
Which is not as much as I used to do, but it's okay, because my goal and my responsibility is also to make sure that I continue to challenge, continue to mentor, continue to train the next generation.
And you do that. Look at all the people that you've developed.
Yeah, I was going to do that next. You must have been proud to have the third chef through the French Laundry be the best chef.
Right, the rising
star chef. Quite.
No, it's extraordinary. It makes me extraordinarily proud. You know, Timothy being the most recent, of course, Corey 3 years ago, and then Grant
six
years ago. Yeah.
Tell me what you thought about the outcome of the top 50 best restaurants in the world.
So the guide, it's a magazine. You know, was I as happy as I've been in the years past? No, but I'm extremely satisfied. I'm the only chef that has two in the top 50.
That's
true. I've been in the top 50 since 2005.
Uh-huh.
So the past 5 years, we've had two restaurants in the top 50. And, I mean, that's historic. I was the first chef to have restaurants back-to-back. French Laundry won the second and third year. So I'm very happy. We're number 32. French Laundry, per se, was number 10. You know, we could have done better. We could have done worse. It's a magazine. It's based on what we did yesterday, not what we're doing tomorrow.
Well, that's a very good way of putting it. But I hate the thoughts of having to go to Copenhagen now.
Well, actually, I was in Copenhagen last week and had dinner at Noma, had lunch at Noma. You know, Renee worked for us for about a year and a half.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And it's extraordinary. I mean,
he
has really captured the spirit of Denmark and interpreted that in a way that is so significant to his personality.
Yeah. What about the one in Brazil with the Amazon products?
I haven't been there.
No, I haven't been there either.
Yeah.
I've been to lots of places in the world. Well, the French are not too happy.
You're going to make people happy and unhappy.
Yeah.
And I think the main thing is to realize that you're there, you're having a great time, you're with your colleagues and your friends, and however it works out, it works out. And we have to celebrate Renee winning. We have to congratulate Ferran for being chef of the decade, and we have to celebrate our own position in the guide, in the list. But more important, we have to respect that this is an industry, it's a community of people who are all working together to help one another and to share.
It sounded like on the tweeters from there, I mean, it sounded like so much fun. It sounded like more fun than the Beard Awards.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, I might sneak that one in next year. Well, listen, I know you have to be off. You're traveling.
Yes.
And I just want to conclude by thanking you. I mean, you have a special section on our website, I believe. And I want to add that this is also a graphically gorgeous book.
Thank you.
Photography, illustrations, and I think people will find it usable and much fun.
It's also suitable for making pressed tongue and brick chicken.
It's not as heavy as John Fulce's new book, which is, 12 or 15 pounds.
Oh, my God.
Oh, it's incredible. Anyhow, thank you again, Thomas.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Be well.
See you soon.
Okay, will do.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, that's it for another week. And we haven't even mentioned all the wonderful restaurant experiences we had over the weekend. We also avoided a major car bomb attempt. And got to walk the High Line, which was just sublime, in Chelsea. At any rate, as I said, that's it for another week. Until same time, same place next week. Bye-bye.